We have a new national security advisor, await a new Democratic national chair, and say goodbye to a champion of civility and decency in politics. We're passing the torch on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Democrats meet to pick a new leader. Will it unify the party and stop the infighting?
It really is a race between Perez and Ellison, but party insiders are not going to win this race. It's not a matter of, like, who you know in Washington. This is a position that requires knowledge and connection to state parties.
And what about those Democrats who voted for some of Trump's cabinet nominees? Might they face a primary challenge from the left next year?
No one at this point has any concrete plans for primaries yet. But the Democratic base wants to see real opposition and resistance to the Trump administration and also a proactive agenda that helps working families.
Plus, we remember Bob Michael, the longtime former Republican leader in the House, who believed in something that was once called civility.
He always rose to the occasion. And when he was able to reach across the aisle and accomplish those coalition victories that no one else would have been able to do, is where I think he really loved getting in and doing battle on the floor.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 167 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Ever just want to get away? That was Donald Trump last weekend. Under siege over a fired national security advisor, a failed labor secretary nominee, questions about contacts with the Russians, and an executive order knocked down by the courts, the president decided to hold off on governing and return to campaigning, something he loves to do. And he packed them in at a rally in Melbourne, Florida. You probably won't be surprised to hear what he said 2 minutes into his speech.
I also want to speak to you without the filter of the fake news. The dishonest media, which has published one false story after another, with no sources, even though they pretend they have them, they make them up in many cases. They just don't want to report the truth, and they've been calling us wrong now for 2 years. They don't get it, but they're starting to get it. I can tell you that. They've become a big part of the problem. They are part of the corrupt system. When the media lies to people, I will never, ever let them get away with it. I will do whatever I can that they don't get away with it. They have their own agenda, and their agenda is not your agenda.
In fact, the media was so dishonest that it missed one of the great stories of all time.
You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden.
What happened in Sweden was considerably worse than the massacre at Bowling Green, but there was no media coverage whatsoever. Regardless, the theme of a dishonest media continues. Last week, Trump tweeted, "The fake news media, failing New York Times, NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN, is not my enemy. It's the enemy of the American people." This was too much for Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican, who expressed his displeasure on NBC's Meet the Press.
That's how dictators get started. They get started by suppressing a free press. In other words, in consolidation of power, when you look at history, the first thing that dictators do is shut down the press. And I'm not saying that President Trump is trying to be a dictator. I'm just saying we need to learn the lessons of history.
And while we're on it, here was an interesting claim by the president over the size of his victory in November, a subject he continues to focus on. Trump said this.
I guess it was the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan.
Peter Alexander of NBC News begged to differ.
You said today that you had the biggest electoral margin since Ronald Reagan with 304 or 306 electoral votes. In fact, President Obama got 365 and
2008. Well, I'm talking about Republican.
President Obama, 332, yeah. And George H.W. Bush, 426 when he won as president. So why should Americans trust
him? Well, no, I was told, I was given that information. I don't know. I was just given. We had a very, very big margin.
I guess my question is, why should Americans trust you when you accuse the information they receive of being fake when you're providing information that's...
Well, I don't know. I was given that information. I've seen that information around. But it was a very substantial victory. Do you agree with that?
You're the president.
If Trump has problems with his Electoral College history, he may be interested in this week's trivia question. Yes, he carried 30 states, getting 306 of the 538 electoral votes. But in the 58 presidential elections, Trump's Electoral College margin ranks as only the 46th best. There have been 45 elections in which the winning candidate won a larger percentage of the electoral vote than Trump. And now the trivia question. What president had the largest percentage of electoral votes? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Not long after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, conservative opposition began coalescing around the country. While much of it was directed at the president, a lot was also aimed at Republicans. The objection? The GOP talked a good game, but once in power, they acted just like Democrats. And so these conservatives did what they could to beat back those rhinos, those Republicans in name only, who to them sounded like Democrats. These Tea Party conservatives didn't bring the GOP to power in the Senate, but they made their voices heard. In Pennsylvania, rather than take on Pat Toomey in the Republican primary and likely lose, Arlen Specter quit the GOP. In Florida, the sudden arrival of Marco Rubio pushed Charlie Crist, long considered the favorite for an open Senate seat, out of contention. Mitch McConnell's establishment choice in Kentucky lost to upstart Rand Paul. Conservative incumbent Bob Bennett lost out to even more conservative candidates in Utah. You get the picture. The conservatives' message was, we're here to stay and we mean business. Fast forward to 2017. Donald Trump is president, and now it's the left that's angry. Massive demonstrations the day after the inaugural. Protesters at town hall meetings held by Republican incumbents. And, in some cases, anger at those Democrats who vote for Trump's cabinet choices. Stephanie Taylor is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a liberal group trying to move the Democrats and the country to the left. Stephanie, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie, that was the longest intro I've written in my life. Are you still awake after all that?
I am.
But basically what I was trying to show is that there was a lot of anger from the right in 2010. Republicans were selling out, and a considerable amount of progressives in 2017 who fear that Democrats, in some cases, are doing the same kind of selling out. Well, how do you see all this?
Well, I actually think that the country is more aligned than you would think. And what I mean by that is that our polling shows that progressive positions are winning positions supported by the majority of Americans, Democratic, Republican, and Independent. When you poll issue by issue, especially on the economic populist issues, you see that 70% support expanded Social Security, 71% support debt-free college, 71% support allowing everyone to buy health insurance through Medicare. What I think people are most frustrated about is a Congress that is too beholden to special interests and corporate interests and not truly representative of where the majority of people are. People are rightfully sick and angry about our broken system and about the corporate capture of our democracy.
That almost sounds like the argument Bernie Sanders made in 2016, directed not only at the Republican Congress, but members of his own party as well.
We are definitely asking Democrats, in addition to Republicans, but Democrats also have a responsibility to step up and really represent the will of the people. And that's one distinction that I think is really important that I want to make between the Tea Party and progressives, you know, because I think a lot of people sort of draw this comparison between the Tea Party and the progressives. The Tea Party wants politicians to take positions that are wildly out of the mainstream. What progressives are doing is asking Democrats to take these positions that are thoroughly within the mainstream, that are thoroughly supported by three-fourths of the country. Again, when we're asking people to step up and stop corporate capture of our democracy, when we're asking them to support these economic populist positions and make the economy work for everyone, we're asking them to take positions supported by 70% of Americans. And so I think there's a real difference there between the Tea Party and progressives. And the progressives are really saying, let's have a Congress that's working for, you know, three-fourths of what America wants.
No, I agree with you, and I see the distinction, and you're absolutely right. But let me go back to the thing I was mentioning earlier about how some on the party want to punish or primary members of their own party, for example, voting for Trump's nominees. There was an interesting moment earlier this week in Washington during the final forum of those Democrats competing to head up the DNC. Later in the show, we'll talk more about that DNC contest. But while Tom Perez, who was one of the hopefuls, was making a case, a woman stood up in the back of the hall and asked him this pointed question. I'm going to play the tape. I'm hoping you can hear what she said.
Secretary Perez, I will ask again. Will you commit to supporting primary challengers who fight against incumbent Democrats who refuse to fight Trump's agenda, yes or no? Can you commit to supporting those primary challengers who run against incumbent Democrats?
That was a tough piece of tape to play, but she wanted to know if Perez would commit to supporting primary challenges to those Democrats who, in her words, have supported the Trump agenda. You know, many point out that Republicans spent 8 years bottling up President Obama's initiatives, that Merrick Garland didn't even get a vote or even a hearing, and so Democrats should respond in kind by opposing the Trump cabinet and Supreme Court picks. And if they don't, they should get a primary challenge in 2018.
Well, I should make clear that no one at this point has any concrete plans for primaries yet. But I do think that Democratic voters at large, the Democratic base, wants to see real opposition and resistance to the Trump administration and also wants to see a proactive agenda that helps working families. And, you know, this is one of those cases where it's like, help us help you, in that this is both good policy, but it's also good politics for the Democratic Party. And one thing I wanted to share with you and your listeners was the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. We just commissioned a poll in the past few weeks in red or swing states with Democratic incumbent senators who are up for re-election in 2018. So we polled places like West Virginia and Ohio and Missouri and Montana. And one thing that we found that was absolutely shocking was that more people believe overall that Trump is fighting for regular working families than believe Democrats are fighting for regular working families. Overall, when you aggregated all the results of the poll, 34% believe Democrats in D.C. are fighting more for regular working families, while 56% believe Democrats in D.C. are fighting more for big money special interests, while 49% believe Trump is fighting for regular working families, and 44% believe Trump is fighting for billionaires and bankers. That is really bad news for the Democratic Party.
That is remarkable.
Democrats cannot win if that is what voters believe about the party at large. That taints everybody who tries to run on the Democratic Party ticket. And so I think that these are some real warning signs that activists are trying to flag for the Democratic Party, you know, that things need to change dramatically in order to retake power.
Those are remarkable numbers, and I'm going to take a look at that poll. That's pretty remarkable. I'd love to have future conversations about that. But when I'm thinking about the Joe Manchins and the Heidi Heitkamps and Joe Donnellys and John Testers of the world, they feel that these are Trump states that if they oppose Trump on all cases, they'll be easily defeated in November. And the reason Democrats like that survive in these red states is that they see both sides, or they can accommodate their voting record. How do progressives buy that argument? Do they say, well, you know, if you're a Democrat, if you have a D after your name, you should be standing up for the party and not for Scott Pruitt, for EPA administrator, for example, or even Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court?
Not at all, and here's why. It's not like voters are clamoring for Congress to confirm a foreclosure king as Treasury Secretary, like Steve Mnuchin, or as you brought up, you know, Scott Pruitt at the EPA, someone who's a longtime enemy of the EPA and the environment. You know, these positions are wildly out of line with what Americans want. So first and foremost, we think it's obviously more important to represent the American people than to work with Trump or to compromise with Trump or accommodate Trump. But again, I would also point to those polling numbers that we saw. You know, you brought up Joe Manchin. You know, West Virginia was one of the places that we polled. Trump may be popular in West Virginia, but he also is seen as being more on the side of regular working families than Democrats in West Virginia. And so the best way to win those voters is to show that you are on the side of working people and not corporations, that you also are a fighter and a champion for working people, and not doing things like going out and voting to confirm a foreclosure king as Treasury Secretary.
I want to play a piece of tape, a part of an interview that Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill had last week on this the Mark Reardon Show on St. Louis's KMOX. I don't for a second think of Claire McCaskill in the same vein as I do the Joe Manchins, the Heidi Heitkamps. But at the same time, she sounded very concerned. Let me play this tape.
Where is your party right now when it comes to blue-collar Missouri voters? Is the Democratic Party too liberal for Missouri? And where is Claire McCaskill? And I guess the follow-up question would be that, and I don't know if you've decided, are you for sure going to run in 2018?
Yes, I'm for sure going to run. And I may have a primary because I'm there is in our party now some of the same kind of enthusiasm at the base that that the Republican Party had with the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeing that same, and many of those people are very impatient with me because they don't think I'm pure. For example, they think I should be voting against all of Trump's nominees.
Stephanie Taylor, the message I got out of that is the base is angry.
Well, I think that she's once again drawing, you know, this false equivalence between progressives and the Tea Party, which I would fundamentally disagree with. I think that what you see is really people at large, both Democrats, Republicans, independents, this groundswell of anger that Congress isn't fighting for working people more, that Congress is too captured by Goldman Sachs, by Wall Street, by corporations, and wanting to see some appetite among our leaders to do something about it, to really be in there every day fighting to try and make things more equitable and more fair for working people. Senator McCaskill is fundamentally misunderstanding both what the appetite of voters and what people actually want to see from our leaders. And I think it actually perfectly captures some of the struggle of progressive activists to make sure that Democratic leaders can understand really where this frustration is coming from and what voters want to see from them.
The split we saw in 2016, the outsiders, the Bernie Sanders voters against the establishment, the Hillary Clinton supporters, does that split still exist?
I'm sure it does. I've seen some on social media. I think that the more powerful split within the Democratic Party right now, and one that I think gets less attention, is between, you know, the corporate wing and the Warren wing. You know, whether the future of the Democratic Party, you know, right after the election, you saw folks like, they call themselves centrist think tank Third Way, calling for Democrats to be more moderate in their economic positions to better appeal to Republicans. We think that's fundamentally wrong. And what you actually see is more of this ongoing battle between the corporate wing and the Warren wing, people who want the Democrats to be more tepid, to be more cautious, to be more beholden to Wall Street, to be more aligned with corporate interests. And then everybody else, you know, the rank and file activists, the voters who want Democrats to be up there fighting for working families.
What's the one thing you think progressives should be doing now that we're in the age of Trump and as we're approaching the 2018 midterms?
I think that we have to tell a story to Americans about how Donald Trump is on the side of corporations and Goldman Sachs and Wall Street and not on the side of working people. And not just Donald Trump, obviously, but the Republican Party at large. But especially Donald Trump, you know, going back to those polling numbers that I shared, it is very, very bad news for us if people really believe that Donald Trump, who is absolutely stalking his cabinet with billionaires and Goldman Sachs executives, you know, the idea that he would be on the side of working people is laughable, but we're not doing a good job of conveying that. And I think that the single most important thing we can do is in all of our messaging and everything we say and do and share to draw that distinction and make sure people understand whose side he's really on.
Stephanie Taylor is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. For more information, go to boldprogressives.org. Stephanie, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
In the initial days and weeks after Donald Trump's stunning victory last November, Democrats made it clear they had no idea what hit them. As the weeks turned to months, Trump opponents responded to the new president's actions with demonstrations around the country, but there was no cohesive strategy, there was still no United Democratic Party, and there was no one person who spoke for them. Democrats hope that all begins to change starting this weekend as DNC members from around the country convene in Atlanta to elect a new national chair. We all remember what happened to the last one. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced out last summer after WikiLeaks revealed her role in making sure Hillary Clinton, and not Bernie Sanders, won the nomination. And her interim successor, the CNN contributor Donna Brazile, was also hurt by a WikiLeaks leak. We learned in October that she shared questions for CNN-sponsored candidate events in advance with people on Clinton's campaign. To Donald Trump, that was the crime of the century.
Can you imagine if I got the questions? They would call for the reestablishment of the electric chair. Do you agree with it? Right?
But I digress. The Democrats are electing a new party leader this weekend. And Daniel Strauss, who's been covering the story for Politico, joins us to examine the race. Daniel, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so tell me who's running. Tell me who they are and what do they represent? Who are they?
We essentially have like two or three tiers here. In the top tier, we have former Labor Secretary Tom Perez and Congressman Keith Ellison, who are essentially the front runners in this race. Below them are South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, South Carolina Democratic Party Chairman Jamie Harrison, until recently, New Hampshire Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley, and then also running are some people that most Democrats haven't heard of, even within the DNC orbit. Idaho Democratic Party Executive Director Sally Boynton Brown, and J.Mu Green, who until a little while ago was a Fox News analyst.
So basically, aside from the South Bend mayor, and we'll talk about him in a bit, the top two frontrunners are considered Ellison and Perez. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you buy the case, and people have been saying this a lot, do you think it's fair to say that this is seen as a race between, well, two surrogates in a sense, Ellison for the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren progressive wing, and Perez represents the Obama, Clinton, I don't know, more establishment wing?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's what all the candidates bristle at. But if you look at their endorsements and support, which they proudly tout, it's hard to not associate them that way. Perez has been endorsed by Democrats like Attorney General Eric Holder, Kathleen Sebelius, and Vice President Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Keith Ellison has been backed by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. He's also been backed by a number of other top, more establishment-aligned congressional Democrats like Chuck Schumer, but most of the support from major Obama administration officials or former officials are for Perez.
Democrats are debating, or they've been debating, I guess, ever since November, what the lesson was, the lesson they learned, if there was one, in Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump. How do the candidates see it? If they're asked, why did we lose, what's their answers?
Look, this is one thing that Howard Dean, who's sort of an exalted figure in Democratic National Committee circles, warns, which is that party insiders are not going to win this race. It's not a matter of, like, who you know in Washington. This is a position that requires knowledge and connection to state parties, and that's the real question here. Who has really connected more to state party chairs and Democrats out in these individual states rather than Washington?
Let me ask you a question that I know is sensitive for Democrats, and it's a sensitive question, and I'm not sure if I'm asking this correctly, but given what Trump has said about Muslims, and given the fact that Keith Ellison is one of the few Muslim members of Congress, are there any implications in electing Ellison? Does it set up an obvious us against them? Am I asking this question wrong?
Some Democrats are worried that if Keith Ellison is elected, he and by proxy the Democratic Party could be painted as sort of anti-Jewish in a way. But listen, I don't think that any past comments he's made have really caused serious damage to his campaign. And I've been talking to Democratic National Committee members closely throughout this long race, and none of them have really brought that up as a deciding factor in their votes. What they've been more worried about is how similar the next chair would be to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's widely considered a disaster among Democratic National Party officials. So when Ellison jumped into the race, he felt a lot of pressure to promise to drop out of Congress if elected, and he eventually did.
In other words, if he's elected, he will resign, which will make him a full-time chairman, right?
Right.
I'm going to throw a bunch of names out at you, and I'm not playing a game here, but just let me throw a bunch of names out. Helen Westwood, David Wilhelm, Don Fowler, John White. Do those names mean anything to you?
Those are past DNC chairs.
Very good. But I'm just wondering, very good, and I'm glad you know that. And I'm just wondering how many of us do know that.
Listen, very few. You know, I was talking with Barney Frank a few months ago, and he, in his very Barney Frank fashion, asked me to name 4 past DNC chairs. And I knew that, but most people can't, and Frank himself couldn't. It depends on who you're talking to. There are some DNC members who really care about this stuff, and that is something that they might know or really care about, but the majority of people do not.
I guess the reason I asked you that question is that with a seeming lack of a Democratic leader in the country in the wake of Hillary Clinton's defeat in November, do we think that whoever heads up the DNC will automatically become a household name or not?
That's usually what happens. When the party out of power elects a new chair or has a party committee chair, they take an outsized role. That's usually not the same when the party controls the White House. They act as a chief leader of the party and a major spokesperson. And so since Democrats don't control the White House and have very little control in Congress, being DNC chair would be an influential position.
Earlier this week, we asked a bunch of our readers to suggest some questions regarding the DNC race. Let me just read a few of them. Katie Payne of Durham, New Hampshire, she wanted to know why those running for the DNC chair needed to raise money. She said she got a solicitation from one candidate who needed money. He said because he was far behind the competition. And I guess Katie wanted to know what the money would be used for.
Well, for travel, for advertising, for staff and outreach, and really just running a campaign. It's not quite the same for running for DNC chair as it is running for, say, Congress, but it's a little more serious than running for student council, which is the joke among DCers about what this race really is. There is a lot of money required to run for DNC chair, and we did a story a little while ago and found that the minimum is about $100,000, and candidates like Perez and Ellison are looking at budgets that are closer to $500,000 or even above that.
Brendan Orner from Montrose, Pennsylvania, asked about who Howard Dean was supporting. I saw that on Wednesday morning, Deans endorsed the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. Here's Dean talking about him on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Pete is a South Bend, Indiana mayor, 36 years old, two tours of duty in Afghanistan. Most important thing, he's the outside the beltway candidate. This party is in trouble. Our strongest age group that votes for us is under 35, and they don't consider themselves Democrats. They elected Barack Obama twice. They didn't elect Hillary Clinton, but voted 58% for her. They don't come out during the midterms. They don't come out for down ballot voters. Our leadership is old and creaky, including me. And we've got to have this guy, 36 years old, running this party. And I had dinner with him last night. He is really, really capable and smart. He runs a city of 100,000 people. He's got 1,000 people in his workforce. He's what we need.
Daniel Strauss, Pete Buttigieg, what say you?
Listen, I mean, he's not wrong. There are a lot of Democrats who find Buttigieg very impressive. He is young. He's very charismatic. He's very well-spoken. And he is an inspiring story, like Dean said. He is not, by any means, the presumptive nominee for DNC chair, but he's, for a while now, even before he jumped into this race, has been regarded as a possible leader of the Democratic Party in the future and near future. And he has been a competitive candidate throughout this race.
I have an even more basic question, and this comes from Fran Taylor of Lakes Region, New Hampshire, and she wanted to know who gets to vote for the DNC chair. That's a good question.
447 voting DNC members who are made up of state party officials and former and current Democratic elected officials.
And if, given the fact that there are 7, 8, maybe 9 candidates in the race, if nobody gets a, did somebody need a majority and it goes to subsequent ballots? Is that how it works?
Yes. So after the first ballot, goes to a second ballot and it keeps going. But after the second ballot, the lowest vote getting candidate is cut off. So it's an elimination. It's kind of like musical chairs.
Do you have a guess? Do you think who wins?
The indicators we are looking at suggest that it really is a race between Perez and Ellison, but you have to pay attention beyond the first ballot, and everything could be scrambled after that.
And do you think that no matter whoever wins, the party can see some semblance of unity going into 2017 and beyond?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, listen, if Ellison wins, the Sanders wing of the party will be satisfied. But we've also seen some strong indicators that if Perez wins, a lot of former supporters of Ellison and thereby probably supporters of Bernie Sanders would also be okay with that. And then there are other candidates like Buttigieg who are pretty popular or considered pretty tenable among rank-and-file DNC members. And then people like Jamie Harrison have strong relationships with state parties, and they would be very happy with that.
Daniel Strauss is a reporter for Politico and has been covering the race for DNC chair. Daniel, it was great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll live each day in peace and hope that we will one day reach.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question. And it was a strange one. Who was the last member of the cabinet to have a strange middle name? The answer? Robert Strange McNamara, the Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And the randomly selected winner is Jacob White of Jackson Heights, New York. Jacob wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutton puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more, on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Before we go, a sad note. Bob Michael died last week. He's the former Republican congressman from Illinois who served 38 years in the House, rising to become minority leader, but who never served in the majority. In fact, he announced he would retire in 1994, a year that turned out to be the first time the GOP won control of the House since 1952. If you know anything about me and the political junkie, it's that I care a lot about civility and decency. Bob Michael was a decent, civil guy whose own ideology, he was a tried-and-true Midwest conservative, never got in the way of him being a gentleman, true to his word. Missy Tessier is the senior communications strategist for the Podesta Group, a lobbying and public affairs firm here in Washington. In a previous life, she was Bob Michael's press secretary. And she was the first person I thought of when I heard of his death. Missy, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Ken. It's a real pleasure to be with you, although it's to comment on a very sad situation. As you know, I have had great, great, great affection for my former boss and retained a really great friendship with him even after he retired, and several of us who were in his kitchen cabinet kind of stuck together. And we'd have quarterly breakfasts with him over at the Capitol Hill Club, and I would help him talk to reporters even after he left public life. Folks like yourself would still be calling me up and saying, hey, you know, can I get Bob's take on this? I'm kind of looking for either, and it was usually to comment on what kind of a path he might see forward to bring people together and come to a common sense legislative solution for whatever the big issue was on the table. And, you know, I always thought it was great that people still reached out to me long after Bob retired, and I was always happy to help them out.
You know, it's so rare to have a member of Congress, former or current, that when somebody passes, everyone was saddened, Democrats and Republicans. I guess he just represented an era that's no longer.
That could be. I think that people now are speaking out more from the edges of the party, and are, because of the voters that they're listening to and others, they tend to be less inclined toward trying to seek common ground, and they want to win on their issue. And there's a lot of value in that, and there's a lot of value in really, really fighting hard for what you believe in and for what your constituents or what you as their legislator, you know, want to represent in that point of view. But the art of hammering out a big deal and the art of hammering out, you know, some way for the parties, you know, the different people to come together and sit in a room until they have a path forward is what I lament the most in these years that have passed since I worked with Bob. You just see the majorities passing things, and then, you know, a president who's either of the same party or not, either vetoing or not. And, you know, people aren't coming into that room together and hammering out deals.
Do you remember when you first met him?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah. I first met Bob when I was working for my previous political mentor, who was Silvio Conti, who represented Western Massachusetts, which is where I hail from. I worked for him right out of college as his press secretary and speechwriter. And he and Bob, he called him Bob Michelle, were the best of friends. And he and Speaker Tip O'Neill and all their wives would get together and play cards and go on these great adventures together. And so I met Bob when I was working for the late Mr. Conti. And then when Mr. Michael was looking for a press secretary after his previous one left, you know, it was a great place for me to go. He's just an extraordinary boss, an extraordinary man. And he had assembled a really terrific team of people who knew him well, who really to their core believed that progress was possible, even when people had very, very strong differing opinions. So I felt very fortunate to be in with that group.
Let me tell you a quick story of how I met him. I was with ABC News.
Yep, and I met you when you were with ABC.
That's right, and this is, I think, 1989, and we're taking a train from Washington to Philadelphia. It was like the anniversary of the Constitution or something like that. And I go over to Bob Michael, and I'm wearing a button. I figured I would meet him, and I'm wearing a button that says, re-elect Harold Velde to Congress.
Oh, good Lord.
And, of course, Harold Velde was the guy Bob Michael used to work for as chief of staff, right?
That's right. He was his predecessor.
So when he saw, and Harold Velde, I think, was chairman of the, or at least not chairman, maybe he's chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee. But anyway, when Bob saw the button, he had this, you know how this uproar, this deep baritone laugh he would have. You know, I just liked him from that initial moment. It was just so great.
Oh, I know. You know, and my job as press secretary was made more difficult by the fact that Bob was an extremely honest person and thought that he needed to answer every question that was ever posed to him by a member of the press. He stopped my heart a few times. Somebody in the cloakroom would call me and say, you know, Bob's talking to some reporters. You might want to get over here.
We can't have that, can we?
Right. And, you know, frankly, I think that, you know, it's very helpful for a democracy and it's very helpful for a legislative body for reporters to have access to, you know, to somebody's unvarnished opinion. But, you know, considering the fact that, you know, there was some, you know, sometimes, you know, he got a little far ahead of himself or whatever, you know, it was just nice to be there when he would have a good conversation with folks. But it's hard to say that, you know, a hard part of your job is working as a press secretary for someone who wanted to give an honest view to answer a question and who also didn't seek out a whole lot of press attention. I mean, I think you know that from having covered him. I mean, he would respond, and if he had something important to say, or if he was leading, you know, kind of a bipartisan effort on the floor, because remember back then he was the minority leader, you know, but he frequently was able to bring together coalitions like the Deserts for the Desert Storm resolution in 1991, I think that was, and other times, you know, when he would have something to say, you know, we'd go up to the gallery and he would, you know, he would say it and he would take questions and move on, but he wasn't someone who really sought out, you know, Missy, I want to be on the front page of the New York Times, or Missy, why is this guy quoted and I'm not? He had a special relationship with the members of his conference who had granted him his leadership position. And I think he also had a very, you know, he's extremely patriotic guy. I mean, nobody has watched the PBS Memorial Day concert or July 4th concert without, you know, without seeing that shot of him in the first row of the audience singing God Bless America. I mean, this is the kind of guy that, you know, I don't know if we'll ever be able to make another one like him.
Well, let me give you a good example of how highly he was thought of. It's the lame duck session of the House. It's November of 1994. Michael, or Michelle, was retiring that year, and the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, had just been defeated for re-election, which was a shocking result, but anyway. But so Bob is on the House floor, and he's offering a resolution praising Foley for his leadership. Let's listen.
Mr. Speaker, you and I have served in this body together since 1965, and during that time we have usually found ourselves on different sides of the issues, but we have forged a friendship for one another based on our mutual respect and love for this institution. You brought to the high position you now hold not only admirable political skills, but personal qualities of the highest order.
And then, in a gesture that clearly stunned Michael, Foley did him one better.
Chair would like to ask my distinguished Republican colleague if he would take the chair.
I'm happy to yield to the distinguished big.
Will the gentleman please take the chair? Oh.
Missy, tell us what happened on that day.
Oh, gosh. I mean, he was just overcome. It's just that kind of a gesture of, you know, just recognition of personal skill and value, and also just the statesman-like way in which Bob had always conducted his business. I mean, we're just kind of second to none, and, you know, this kind of recognition across the aisle was something that Bob, he was just overcome, because it was a spot that he never thought he would attain.
He was in Congress. He was in Congress 38 years, never was in the Speaker's chair. That was such an emotional moment.
It was a very emotional moment of, you know, what might have, could have, should have. But I do believe that in his retirement, he was very much at peace with what he was able to accomplish. And like you said, you know, you can't read the articles and the tributes to him without really kind of scratching your head and wonder how could that man have been as successful leading that conference in the minority for so long.
I was going to say, did he ever talk about frustration or regrets of never being in the majority?
Oh, every day. only every day, Ken. But yeah, it's frustrating. But you have to find your victories, and you know, kind of keeping your conference, you know, your membership in line when you have so very little to give back to them in terms of leadership and in terms of, you know, perks and things like that, and just kind of, you know, taking a victory, you know, on a rules battle or something that you know, your members can't even take home to their districts and say, well, we won this rules fight, you know, and it's like everybody's like, you know, what is that? What does that mean? Why is that important to me?
Talking about that time when Tom Foley allowed Bob Michael to take the speaker's chair, I had Bob on this show not long after Tom Foley died in 2013, and we talked about that moment. Let me play a little bit of that.
It was a very emotional day for me, for that matter, because Tom was giving his swan song as he was leaving the Congress. You know, after that defeat up in his district, I was leaving under a little different terms because I just voluntarily decided that I wasn't going to be running again. But Tom knew me well enough and having been around there that long, that, boy, that would really be something to actually preside over the House, if only for a couple of minutes. As it worked out, the timing was such that I recognized him then to give the final remarks that he made on the floor upon his retirement.
I remember that day very well. It was a special moment.
Oh, yes, it was a special moment.
I also remember that the Republicans were really tired of losing. They were in the minority 40 years. Newt Gingrich, of course, would remind them that of all the time. And a considerable number of Republicans would say that maybe Bob Michael wasn't aggressive enough to get him out of the desert.
You know, it was frustrating. And, you know, I think Bob was the first one to give credit to, you know, to Newt and others for trying to build the majority that would then be formed in the House. He had been fighting for the party for so long. I mean, you know, it's obviously a bittersweet victory from Bob's perspective, but, you know, could the victories, you know, for the first President Bush have been achieved? Could some of the Reagan initiatives that required Bob going across the aisle have been achieved for the Republican Party without him? I doubt it. And so you have to kind of take your victories where you find them at the time, and, you know, to try to look at, you know, what your opportunities would be moving forward. And things change. I mean, imagine if we had social media back then. I mean, imagine, it's an entirely different world in terms of communication. But I would argue that we don't see the level of oratory that Bob and some of the others at that time brought to the House floor or to the Senate floor. We don't see a whole lot of the other things that really kind of make you think about the institution of the Congress and what a very important place it is. And, you know, a floor speech can have just a tremendous impact within the chamber that you can never get out of a tweet. So there's a lot to be said for what he accomplished, a lot to be said for what needed to succeed him. If that's an argument that some would make, then you can't turn back the clock.
I'm sorry, Missy, you lost a friend. I'm sorry for all of us, that we lost Bob, but I'm glad we had him for as long as we did, and I think we miss him more than we know.
I think we do. Thank you so much, Ken. I really had a good time talking to you.
Missy Tessier is a senior communication strategist for the Podesta Group and a former press secretary for Bob Michael. Again, Missy, it was just great talking to you about our friend.
Great. Thanks, Ken.
Here's Michael saying goodbye to his colleagues in 1994.
I just want to say to all the members on both sides of the aisle how much I appreciate the camaraderie and the cordiality that I've enjoyed during my tenure in this body, and all those wonderful good things that have happened to me this past year and your acknowledgement from time to time, it's overwhelming. And I just want you all to know, some of us, you know, chose to leave voluntarily, some obviously did not, but that's the way the system works. But the more important thing is, I guess, those memories that we take away from this body, hopefully they'll always be cherished ones of those wonderful days we spent as a member of the U.S. Congress. Thank you, each and every one, and I yield back to the distinguished speaker.
That was Bob Michael on the House floor in 1994, saying his farewell to the institution he loved. Michael, the longtime Republican leader in the House, died last week at the age of 93.
In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs that voices never share. No one did.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering sounds of silence.